My guest this week is the GB News political correspondent, Tom Harwood. Tom, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Thanks. And congratulations on the launch of GB News. I think it's fair to say that the channel has received some criticisms for a number of things, such as dark sets, few sound issues, and even some questions over a sense of balance from some of the hosts. How does GB News respond to those critiques, and what changes are being made editorially?
You know, you're so right to pick up on the changes that are being made, because one of the brilliant things about being a startup, about being relatively small in terms of compared to the other large national broadcasters, we're able to listen to feedback from the people that watch the channel and change things quickly. So actually there's a full set redesign coming along, and there's also a bit of a show rejigging as well. So there's lots of stuff changing in that. We're introducing news bulletins as well, which is something that people really asked for. So when it comes to feedback from the people that watch us, we really, really do take it on board. And I mean, we're only a few weeks old. I think we said at the start of this process that we're going to look quite different the first 6 months in compared to the first 6 minutes in. And I think that will be certainly the case.
And you mentioned there about the fact that this is a startup. And something that I've found particularly interesting about the idea of GB News is having these, you've got new journalists just starting their careers, working hand in glove with some real veteran broadcasters like Andrew Neil, Simon McCoy, Alistair Stewart. And especially in those first few weeks of just getting the channel off the ground, how have you found the atmosphere in the newsroom? How have you found working from these real giants of news broadcasting? I would imagine that everyone learns a lot from each other.
Oh, absolutely. Both inside and outside the newsroom. Actually, the first time that I met Simon McCoy was over a pint just outside the studio, and we sort of all met up on a social occasion. And actually, sometimes the best time to you know, learn from some of the old hands at this, not that I think they'd appreciate me calling them old hands, but some of the real veterans in this industry, and so the people that have achieved so much and reached such heights in their careers, is the best time to talk about that sort of stuff is sometimes socially, and you learn so much just through a normal conversation. So yeah, no, it's a real privilege to be working with such a diverse team. I mean, diverse in age and gender and just about everything. We've got a real cross-section of society here, and I think that makes the editorial all that much stronger.
And there are some who would raise concerns over the diversity of the show and the channel. And I'm talking specifically about the campaign group Stop Funding Hate, who decided to launch a boycott almost of any large company that put their adverts on GB News over fears of it being this new right-wing Fox News-esque new channel. But given that GB News hadn't aired even a second of coverage before this campaign was announced, how seriously as a channel did you take their threats?
Yeah, I mean, this is the point. It's sort of pre-cancellation, isn't it? This idea that before they saw a single second of what was going to be broadcast, they tried to shut it down. It's sort of a campaign against any sort of media plurality. But this organisation, which I think is basically just a Twitter account and some very, very angry people, have been trying to shut down a lot of newspapers in this country, have been trying to go after many actually mainstream publications. So I really don't think that they speak for that many people across the country. And really, when brands are looking at what their advertising strategy should be, it's a good idea to copy what the Co-op has done. I mean, the Co-op went through a similar sort of tricky situation a couple of years ago when people demanded they take ads off the Spectator magazine, and they went through a sort of a big row online, and actually ended up with an editorial policy whereby the Co-op doesn't try and interfere with the editorial of the places it chooses to advertise. And I think that if we reach a point as a society where sort of big brands decide to have this sort of editorial policy as a whole, then these very insular campaign groups will have less of an impact.
Absolutely. And it appears that Stop Funding Hate haven't been too successful in their campaigns, because only on Wednesday we saw that GB News posted its first month's ratings. And it's very interesting reading to look at the Press Gazette's report on this. And I was particularly interested to see that over a third of viewers are under the age of 35. With some slots, the rates of younger viewers actually surpasses the BBC and Sky. So what do you think it is about GB News which captures so many younger viewers?
Yeah, we were all really interested to see these numbers come back. And you're right to notice that some slots we're ahead of Sky and the BBC. I think it's fair to say some slots we're really, really not. And there's quite a difference in terms of viewership throughout the day, at least through linear TV. There's a whole nother story that's happening on YouTube and on our app and through our website where people are streaming stuff digitally. That's a huge, huge market for us. We've had millions and millions of views on our social media platforms, which I think is something that we do that attracts potentially younger people. I think we're the only news organization of our kind that has a TikTok account, for example, and we put news across that way as well. Maybe it's something to do with the avenues that we're using, but maybe also it's to do with an idea that a young generation is after something new, after something fresh, after something potentially less stale. And that's a sort of exciting journey for people to go on. And I think that some of our content is really reaching out to that.
In the Press Gazette's report, something that really stuck out for me was something the GB News head of digital, Becca Hudson, said. And she said that GB News is, and I quote, a digital media business that has a TV channel attached. Now, that's a very different way of broadcasting the news. And do you think this more online-oriented coverage of the news is a model that may inspire other broadcasters and they may want to emulate, especially given the data that was just released showing, you know, millions of online impressions? And those impressions are something that linear TV doesn't always provide and get.
Yeah, no, I mean, if they don't choose to do it now, I think they'll be forced to do it down the line, because we know that the way that people consume news is changing. People don't always sit down in front of a TV for hours on end these days. They might want to get up and do some cooking and take their tablet with them or their phone. You've got the phenomenon of double screening, people scrolling through Twitter and interacting with live TV and the content in that way. And we like to bring in what viewers have written into us in most shows, especially during the daytime. I think that ultimately the way that people consume media in this country is changing, and the way that we watch TV in the next 10 years will be very different to how it was in the last 10 years. So sort of future-proofing ourselves for that, being very adaptable to whatever changes happen, seeing ourselves primarily as this digital operation rather than we're our TV station and everything else is peripheral, really sets us in good stead for the inevitable changes that are going to come in the market in the years to come.
I'd like to ask you about a report you gave for GB News on Monday. I think you know which I'm talking about. It was for Nigel Farage's new show. It was the first episode of that, and it seemed to be very well received. And you were reporting from Whitehall about the anti-lockdown protests, and your report had to be cut short due to some protesters shouting obscenities at you because you are in the media. Now, the anti-lockdown protests, they haven't received as much coverage, and that's something that many were trying to urge GB News to pursue and when it first launched, and try and give them more coverage because they were claiming they were the unheard voices. But do you think that throughout the pandemic, those with, let's say, more questionable opinions have been overshadowing the real reason for these anti-lockdown protests that have been going on right the way through the pandemic, which is simply for those people wanting a return to normality and to not have the economy and their businesses simply on their knees through the various lockdowns?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to give everyone a voice. And at GB News, we try and recognise that there's sometimes more than two sides to every story, let alone one side. And I think that it's important to have healthy national debate on every single option. And we shouldn't just sort of take, just because, for example, the leadership of the Conservative Party and the Labour Party agree on an issue, that doesn't mean that that's a settled issue or that there's no room to discuss it. Now, I don't agree with what the sort of anti-vax protesters were saying at all, but I think that actually some of the stuff going on there was newsworthy. It was newsworthy that number 10 was effectively in lockdown, actually, because no one was allowed in or out the gate. I had to report from outside the gates rather than on the street of Downing Street, because they had completely sealed the gates as a result of potential violence from the protest outside. Now, if coverage was given to the Black Lives Matter protest that had similar security concerns around it, I don't see why that shouldn't have happened with the protest that we saw on Monday. I do think it was a curious time to do an anti-lockdown protest the day that lockdown was lifted, but maybe they had other motivations as well. But no, it was an interesting report, and I think we're going to try and do more sort of in the thick of it style reports, really getting to the heart of an issue. Yes, of course, sitting in our studio that's improving week by week, but also cutting across to our network of journalists around the country. We've got regional journalists in every region of the United Kingdom, and they'll be able to sort of, you know, go live from wherever there's something interesting happening. And I think that that's a real value added to the people that want to watch us.
And of course, one of the others in the thick of it reports, as you said just then, is quite early on in GB News lifespan. And that was, of course, the very dramatic resignation of Matt Hancock. You were there on Whitehall for that. And when there is such a huge resignation like that from probably one of, if not the most important cabinet minister at the moment, bar the prime minister or even the chancellor, that really, I suppose, was GB News's first big test of breaking a story as it was happening. How did you find the fast-paced nature of simply going out into the newsroom, straight onto Whitehall, broadcasting live with that?
Yeah, I mean, it was a challenge logistically for us, because we were actually in the middle of a replay, because it was on a Saturday, if I remember correctly, and we were in the middle of a replay of a show. So we had to interrupt that, start Neil Oliver's show on Saturday a little bit early, and cut to me. I happened to be in Westminster. We got a camera person down there really quickly, although she didn't bring a tripod. I think this is a lesson that we learned, because we ended up standing there for about 3 hours and her arms were getting so tired by the end. Yeah. So I think that's a lesson learned there. But actually, no, being able to talk to a subject like that really quickly with sort of live developments. I mean, as I was talking, it was announced that Sajid Javid would become the new health secretary, and being able to sort of, you know, give some background on that and the dynamics within the Conservative Party while we're sort of there in the thick of it, I think was a really good bit of television and a really good sort of first test of responding to a large news event like that.
Of course, before moving to GB News, you were a reporter with the Westminster gossip site, Guido Fawkes. How have you personally found going from covering politics in a more salacious angle, let's say, to becoming the political correspondent for a mainstream broadcast news network?
Well, one good training in one sense, because at Guido we were all about really fast-paced news. We wanted to beat the BBC all the time in terms of getting stuff out there, and I think we were quite successful in that. People used to have us sort of on news alerts on their phones to get the stories really, really quickly. But you know what? During my time at Guido, I had the privilege to pop up on lots of national broadcasters sort of as more of a commentator as well as a journalist. So I had a lot of experience in terms of sitting there and talking to a camera in a studio, whether it was on Sky, the BBC, Channel 4, and all of these different broadcasters. And I think that experience that Guido afforded me has translated really well into GB News.
Before starting your journalistic career, I'd like to move back in time slightly and look at your time running the student wing of Vote Leave during the 2016 EU referendum campaign. How did you get involved in that campaign?
Well, actually, it's an interesting story, because it was shortly after the 2015 general election, and I was still in sixth form, actually. I was just finishing sixth form, and I saw that Steve Baker and a bunch of MPs who I didn't know at the time but sort of followed had set up a group called Conservatives for Britain. And I noticed that they'd set up this group. It had launched in the Sunday papers, but it had no social media attached. So I set up some of the social media accounts for it, totally unofficially, and they gained quite a large following. And so much so that I ended up being direct messaged by some of the people that were actually running the campaign, saying, sorry, who is this? Is this us? Who are are you? Can we have a chat? So I ended up that night speaking on the phone to Steve Baker and, you know, handing over the passwords to the accounts because they'd gone quite successfully. And then meeting up with a lot of the people that were running that campaign, and through a series of meetings, ended up meeting some people in what was then the Business for Britain headquarters in the summer of 2015, ended up taking over a campaign that had been running for a few years then called Students for Britain, which became the official student wing of the Leave campaign. And I took that on, I think, in September 2015 and ran it right through up until the referendum day.
So at the time, I'd say you were, say, 18 roughly, and so Euroscepticism isn't exactly the most mainstream idea amongst young people, and still isn't. I know I'm too a
Euroskeptic. Back then, it wasn't particularly mainstream amongst any generation.
Exactly. So why did you support Brexit, and what was the thing that really made you a Eurosceptic?
I don't know. I did a internship out in the European Parliament, actually, a very short one, a couple of years beforehand. But by that point, I was already pretty Eurosceptic. I remember watching videos of MEPs debating in the chamber, learning actually about the structures of the European Union, this thing that actually had such control over the lives and the regulations that govern people in this country, and yet that so few people know much at all about. I found it very, very curious that you had sort of this organization that had sort of crept up behind the backs of people, that was calling the shots in so many ways. I mean, how many people knew about the Spitzenkandidaten elections in 2014, and the fact that if you were voting for various members of the European Parliament, if you knew that you could vote for members of the European Parliament at all, you were actually voting for a president of the European Commission. And the idea that there's this organization that had taken on so much more power than it was ever originally conceived to have, and was marching headfirst towards statehood, and very few people were talking about it. And I suppose I sort of read a lot around that, and it became something that I grew to care about quite a lot. And of course, back in those days, back in actually in 2015 even, it wasn't a really contentious issue. People didn't really, it didn't incite the passions amongst so many people that it does today. You could actually have a very normal conversation. I mean, I remember, when was it? It must have been 2014 or 2015, when Owen Jones felt comfortable writing Guardian articles saying we should leave the European Union. Wow. It was only actually during the referendum that the atmosphere became so toxic that it started to be perceived to be a marker of people's values rather than just an academic discussion over whether we should be part of this institution or not. So back in those days, back before the referendum, referendum proper, before we knew when the date of the referendum would be even, I think it was a lot easier to have these discussions, and people actually were a lot more open-minded to hearing the case.
Yeah, and I'm sure even today there are still many people who don't know about the Spitzenkandidaten process as well. But during those long Brexit battles in Parliament from 2018 to 19, with all those late night sittings and those knife edge votes and the Brexit day just being repeatedly postponed, it really was heartache for us Brexiteers at the time. But when all this was going on, particularly as you were, as you say, in the thick of it in Westminster at the time, speaking to the people in power and making these decisions, did you ever think your work on the campaign and your advocacy for leaving the EU, all the way since 2015, as you say, did you ever feel that all that work might have been in vain and potentially Brexit wouldn't happen?
You know what? I remember really, really clearly when I thought, I think we've lost it all. I think this is all gone. And it's when Theresa May decided to stop negotiating with her backbenchers and start negotiating with Jeremy Corbyn, saying that actually we're going to put a customs union on the table here. And it's, you know, if there's one aspect of the European Union that I was most against, that most inspired me to, you know, really get involved, it was getting rid of the wretched customs union and stopping Brussels setting our external tariffs and letting us take control of our own trade policy. That's the thing that actually most excited me throughout the course of the campaign. And it was the thing that this government that was led by someone who voted Remain, that seemed to think that Brexit was only about one issue, not anything to do with the European Union, but about how many migrants were let into the country, which is sort of a second order issue to me. To me, leaving the European Union is about leaving the institutions of the European Union, not necessarily what you do with the powers when you get them back. It's the means of having the powers in the first place. Anyway, the number 10 of that Times didn't seem to think that way at all, and began to negotiate with the opposition in terms of what a Brexit deal should look like. The negotiation became how much should we give away rather than how much should we take. And I remember walking across Westminster Bridge the night that was announced, just looking at my phone, sort of actually messaging a couple of people I knew at the time in number 10, just saying, well, it's hopeless, it's lost. I was despairing, really, really despairing. I mean, thankfully then it was delayed so much that the European elections came along, and that I think is what changed the mind of a lot of Conservative MPs. The fact that there was another popular mandate, that you could see the strength of feeling, the idea that an upstart party that didn't exist a month before the elections had suddenly won those elections, and that Brexit, you do need the occasional democratic reminder for people that get ever so comfortable on the benches of the House of Commons. They sort of forget the people that elected them. And I think those European elections really reminded people in the House of Commons that actually, if they went back on what the referendum result demanded, they wouldn't be sitting on those green benches for very long.
So now that we've had the referendum, we've had all those battles, those long late night sittings, we've had a change of prime minister as a result of this, and a fresh deal, and even a fresh trade deal as well as a result of this, is the Brexit we got the Brexit you were hoping for when you were working on the campaign?
I think broadly, yes. I'm delighted that we've got Liz Truss pinging around just about every continent of the world signing trade deals. I'm delighted that we're able to obviously we took on EU law into our domestic statute books, but we can now go through that bit by bit and chuck bits out. Am I totally happy with the way the Irish protocol works? No. Would I like some more control over fishing? Yes. But ultimately, we get these yearly negotiation quotas for that, and there's the option to invoke Article 16 of the protocol. So broadly, I think I'm fairly happy with how it's gone. I mean, looking back to, I don't know, 2013, I'd have been delighted to leave the European Union and join EFTA or the EEA, and that would have a far lower level of sovereignty than we enjoy today. So, I mean, just comparing to where we are, how far we've come and how much we won, I think sometimes we don't sort of look at how significant that was and how clear that victory became.
Definitely. And with victory, of course, during the 2016 EU referendum, you worked closely with everyone's favourite political strategist, Dominic Cummings. What was he like to work with?
Do you know what? I think I sat in about two meetings with him. Once he made me a cup of tea. But I wouldn't say that I knew him very well. I could sort of see him at the edge of the room. He had sort of in the main campaign room of Vote Leave HQ, there were sort of all these banks of desks, and then an office in the corner where Dom Cummings and Matthew Elliott would sort of sit and discuss, and you could sort of see them sketching on whiteboards and having important phone calls and all those sort of things. But it wasn't really my place to sort of, you know, step in there and see exactly what was going on. I remember seeing him pacing on the night of that vote, because I was sort of sitting in the back there sheepishly. I was up in Durham where I was at university during the day of the vote. I got the last train down to London, getting in actually after the polls had closed, probably getting into Vote Leave HQ around midnight, and sort of seeing everyone sort of pacing but sort of excited, looking at the data, sort of saying, actually, this is going a little bit better than we thought, sort of seeing each stage sort of where we needed to be and where the results actually were, and getting increasingly excited until actually the data guys called it about an hour before the BBC did in the Vote Leave HQ, and we sort of passed around the bottles of, I think it was Prosecco, and everyone was like, no, don't take any pictures of this, oh my god, if we're wrong and it gets out that we've been, you know, quaffing bubbly at a result that hasn't. But yeah, no, I mean, that was just sort of a remarkable moment. And then of course he stood up on that desk in that famous footage that I I actually gave to the BBC, which they now play whenever they talk about Dominic Cummings. There's sort of my little iPhone footage of him punching that ceiling tile. But no, that was just a magical, magical campaign, a magical moment.
And speaking of the BBC, Mr. Cummings did a big interview with their political editor, Laura Koonsberg, this week. And there have been questions around his integrity and truthfulness with some of the remarks he came out with in this interview. So having worked with him briefly and got to know his working styles during the campaign, what did you make of the interview? Do you think he was telling the whole truth in that?
I think broadly he was. He didn't pull any punches. He was pretty direct. But I think that sometimes you can overinterpret some of this stuff that he said. Like the idea, I mean, I think it's fairly obviously true that Boris Johnson said it's ludicrous that I should become prime minister. Mm. But I mean, you don't take that totally literally. Like the man jokes quite a lot, and he said that it was also ludicrous that Dave or George, i.e. David Cameron or George Osborne, should be prime minister. In fact, actually, if you subscribe to the way that Boris Johnson thinks, it's probably ridiculous that anyone should be prime minister, and that you should have sort of this amount of control and power vested in any one individual.
Just to move away from Brexit and the EU for a moment. So something you and I both have in common is the fact that we've both been interns at the Institute of Economic Affairs, a free market think tank based around the corner from Parliament, for those listeners who don't know about it. How did your time at the IEA influence your views and prepare you for life in Westminster?
Well, I got that internship actually after skipping the afternoon of school with a couple of friends back in 2014, I think it was, to go down to this economics lecture that I'd heard about. It's called the Hayek Memorial Lecture, and I think it happens every year. And we went along and we sat there, and then there were all these sort of gift bags afterwards. And as we were leaving, me and a couple of school friends of mine, we sort of saw there was a drinks reception afterwards. And it was like, well, yeah, we're 16 and we can sort of sneak into this drinks reception and get free alcohol. I love this. This is probably a terrible advert of the IEA, actually, because no, it was entirely our fault. Yeah. We were deceiving them. But no, so we got talking to some people there. And actually, one of the people we got talking to was the outreach officer for the IEA, who sort of, I don't know, passed us his email address and said, well, you should definitely apply for the internship this summer. And that we did, and went along.
Amazing. And that, you know, I too did this summer internship. It was a fantastic experience. And, you know, if there are any listeners who are interested in free market economics and classical liberal thinking, you should definitely have a look at the opportunities that they have, particularly for young people. They have a brilliant network and a wide range of opportunities for young people. So with that, you do, I think it's fair to say, come from the more classical liberal tradition. And, you know, throughout the pandemic, you've been quite vocal about encouraging as many people as possible, particularly young people, to get the COVID-19 vaccine. But how comfortable are you with the Prime Minister's announcement this week that people must be fully vaccinated to enter certain venues and places, such as nightclubs? Do you think this is the right decision?
Yeah, it's something that I've been wrestling with, actually. I think that broadly at a time of war, there are no libertarians. I think that you can make a classical liberal argument in favour of the lockdowns that we initially went into, the sort of the harm principle argument, where the state has an obligation to protect the liberty of people not to kill other people, if you see what I mean. Yeah. So I think that there's an argument there. But when it comes into what I get really worried about is when we're talking about things that may stretch beyond the pandemic proper, when we start talking about creating societal infrastructure that will still be with us after the pandemic. I'm relatively relaxed about government intervention in this defined pandemic period. The question for me is, are there endpoints, and are we setting up systems and infrastructure that might sustain beyond the pandemic? That's what I am genuinely really concerned with. And so I'm, when it comes to vaccine passports or whatever we want to call them, if they do come about, I would want to see a very clear sunset clause. But also I would want it to be, you know, a COVID specific only thing, because I don't want them to build this sort of infrastructure that so much stuff that the government does that is designed to be temporary, they think, actually, I rather like this, and maybe we should continue to have this state-issued digital document keeping track of our citizens. I don't think that there's any justification for that to continue beyond a pandemic. So on those grounds, I think that it's harder to justify a COVID passport. But I'm relatively open-minded about intervention during the defined pandemic period.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it was the economist Milton Friedman who said there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government measure. So I do agree. We'll have to see what those proposals are when they come out. And of course, there does need to be some sort of sunset clause around this. But given that there's been so much backlash around this announcement, particularly on the Conservative backbenches, what do you think are the chances that the Prime Minister will U-turn on this, or even, dare I say it, face a Commons defeat?
I think the Prime Minister would really quite like not to ever have to bring the legislation forward in the first place. I think the ideal situation that the Prime Minister foresees, and I think he hinted to this in the 1922 committee meeting this week, where he's trying to assuage the concerns of many of his backbenchers. I think his ideal situation would be to say that we're introducing these passports, then for so many young people to be vaccinated, to be able to make an announcement come mid-September saying, you know what, we really were going to introduce these vaccine passports, but because the levels of vaccination among 18 to 30 year olds are now at, you know, 90% or whatever it is, we feel like we no longer need to because everyone's vaccinated anyway and it would be no point checking on the door. I think that's the announcement that he would like to make. It'll be an interesting question to see whether the rates of vaccination tick up, because, I mean, if we're being honest, Boris Johnson doesn't want to introduce vaccine passports. He's someone that's been on the very liberal end of things in the past, and reading many of his Spectator and Telegraph columns over the years against the introduction of ID cards, for example, you can see how vociferously he'd argue against this were he not in government. I think that ultimately this is just a tool to try and get people vaccinated and get more people vaccinated, particularly young people. And if the comms around this works and enough young people got vaccinated, as we saw in Israel, they sort of stopped asking for what they called their green card system, a vaccine passport, just because everyone was vaccinated, really, and there was no point asking on the door because everyone had one.
Do you think the pandemic has made Boris more of an authoritarian, more of a state intervention kind of prime minister compared to the more libertarian minded Boris that he used to be?
I think Boris the columnist is libertarian minded. Boris the politician is not. Mm-hmm. One of the first things that Boris did as London mayor was ban drinking on the tube. Now, I can imagine that if he were a Telegraph columnist or a Spectator editor and it was a Labour mayor that banned drinking on the tube or across TfL, the amount of rage against the sort of new Puritanism that that would represent that would come through his writing would no doubt be intense. So I don't actually buy this argument that Boris has ever been particularly strongly libertarian when he's been in positions of government, but he certainly has when he's been on the outside. And I think that that's a trap that many, many politicians fall into. You don't want anyone else to have any power whatsoever, but when it's you with the power, you're slightly more relaxed about it.
My final question around the idea of the vaccine passports here, and have you heard anything, speaking to various MPs and ministers, about potential caveats to or exemptions for the vaccine passports, particularly for those who cannot receive the jab for medical reasons? Because that's a concern many have had, and there has been some sentiment amongst the general public that there hasn't been enough focus throughout the whole pandemic on those who cannot receive certain treatments or vaccinations for medical reasons.
I asked about the medical exemption on Monday. On Tuesday, I asked the Prime Minister's spokesman about this, actually. And of course, when the government mandated vaccinations in care home settings, they set out a list of exemptions for medical reasons where this mandate wouldn't apply. And the Prime Minister's spokesman told me that when the vaccine passport legislation was brought forward, because of course it would require primary legislation, there would also be a list of exemptions.
Okay, well, that's reassuring to hear. And of course, we are expecting to hear more information around this announcement over the next few days. So my final question is that now that Brexit has happened, the pandemic, based on current data, seems to be heading into its final stages. What do you see as the next big challenge that the UK faces?
Well, I think we're not out of the woods of the pandemic yet, with potentially 100,000 cases a day, maybe 1,000 hospitalizations a day, maybe a few hundred deaths a day. I think a lot of people haven't quite registered what the Prime Minister's been saying about the fact that we will have an exit wave, whatever we do. There will be a spike in, or if not a spike, a sort of hump in hospitalizations and deaths as we leave this pandemic, as we shift from pandemic to endemic disease in this country. So I think that there's still a way to go on that, but ultimately the Prime Minister has this sort of nebulous phrase that he wants the remainder of his time as Prime Minister to be about, leveling up, and a far cry from his brilliant Greenwich speech that he gave in February 2020, that set out sort of the idea of Britain being a global champion of open markets and free trade. The levelling up speech that Boris Johnson gave just a week or so ago seemed to have none of that ideological fervour and very little in terms of substance. Mm. So I think if the Prime Minister really wants to have a driving mission for he's been Prime Minister actually for 2 years, yeah, this Saturday will be the 24th of July, and he became Prime Minister on the 24th of July 2019. So we're 2 years in, potentially 2 years out from an election. The second half of his premiership really needs to be defined. He's got Brexit, he dealt with the vaccines well, but actually unless he defines exactly the principles by which he will level up the country and how that will happen, what demons he'll have to slay, I'm afraid that the next 2 years of his premiership could become quite nebulous and forgettable.
Okay, Tom Harwood, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.